Today's program has been brought to you by Clarkson Potter Publishers, the only dedicated lifestyle group within Random House. Potter invites readers to live well. We seek tastemakers, visionaries, and rising stars and partner with them to craft books and products that define their brand while engaging, entertaining, and instructing their audience. Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Grace Bonney, and you're listening to After the Jump on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Thank you for listening. You can listen live every Monday at noon at HeritageRadioNetwork.org, or you can download the podcast on iTunes for free every week. This week, I'm very excited to be talking with Alexandra Lang. She is a critic, journalist, and architectural historian based in Brooklyn. And I know her best from several articles she's written for The Observer, and the most recent being my favorite. That is, it was called Craft Wars, Don't Put a Bird on It, Saving Craft from Cuteness. So today we're going to be talking about a lot of topics that I think people maybe don't know are happening within the blog community, among bloggers, among blog readers, ranging from what does craft mean to people? What does cute mean to people? Is it okay to make craft cute? And a lot of other things that I think people are sort of discussing, but maybe are afraid to bring to light. So we're going to talk about some of those things today. So thanks for being here, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
So before we started recording, we were talking about sort of what does craft mean and how difficult it can mean to actually put a label on what is craft. So I don't want to force either of us to define craft. It's way too difficult and we cannot do that in 30 minutes. But I wanted her to talk about how you see from sort of the outside, from more mainstream media, maybe the evolution of craft to what you've seen over the last couple of years. I think from inside the blog community, I've watched craft change a lot over the last few years. I think the people that I've admired as a blogger are people who I think were very informed by like a 70s definition of craft. And So I associate craft with people like Todd Oldham and people who are building things a lot with wood, who are using like multiple processes to make things. And I think over the last few years, I've watched craft become a lot more stripped down and very much more about like ornamentation and decoration. How have you watched that evolution change?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Todd Oldham definitely comes at craft from a design perspective. I mean, all of his work is really informed by 1950s and 1960s design, which I think is something that a lot of people aren't aware of. And this is definitely a crusade of mine, is to get the references put back into discussions of design, even if it's new design. So that's kind of a side note, but so there's that aspect of design. Then there's the whole DIY movement, which can operate at a lot of scales. You know, that can be everything from, you know, building your own shack in the backyard to making your own wine in the basement to sewing your own clothes. But then I think what we've seen really over the past couple of years via Etsy, and especially via social media like Pinterest, is a rise in crafts that are being done in the home, mostly by women, and mostly at a small scale, like making clothes for your children, or making garlands, or, you know, decorating your kid's room. A lot of the things that are getting shared are very home focused, and it's people that want to make their environment their own and aren't seeing what they want in the marketplace and want to get back to their own creativity for whatever reason, either they have a desk job or they're at home all day with their children. So I think that the way craft has started to skew more and more female in the mainstream media, and the reason for my post was this new show Craft Wars, which definitely takes that aspect of the way craft is being portrayed and runs with it.
Let's talk about Craft Wars for a minute. For people who aren't familiar with this show, it's Tori Spelling is the host, and it's a reality program with sort of an elimination format, like Project Runway or any of the other shows, where they bring on contestants and they're given, I believe it's two challenges per show.
There's a first, I think it's like an hour long challenge where they're basically given something very fast to do, and then one person is eliminated in that challenge, and then two people go on to the longer term challenge, which is still only I think, you know, 5 or 6 hours, and is at a larger scale. And it took me watching this show a few times to realize that I think it's in that format because they only want to pay for one night of a hotel for mm-hmm. all of the contestants. So they have to do both of the challenges in the same day. I could be wrong, but this is my analysis. So it's like, it's the first season of the show. It's on TLC. So they are doing this somewhat on the cheap. And mm-hmm. I think that that is framing some of the ways that these challenges are done. The other thing that's framing the challenges is that the whole show is sponsored by Michaels. And so all the most of the stuff they're using on the show is new stuff mm-hmm. That you can buy at Michaels. That is also really, I think, skewing the way they're doing the competition.
Well, it's interesting. I'm glad you mentioned the Michaels thing, because I think a lot of times Michaels, I mean, I have a knee-jerk reaction to the idea of Michaels. I shop there, I have no problem with it. But I do think of sort of a type of craft that's very cutesy, like gluing fake flowers on things. It has sort of like a not a very high quality connotation right. to me.
I think of craft foam, exactly. which I have to say I've had some really fun experiences with.
Yes.
But I would not actually be presenting them as crafts. I'd be presenting them as something fun that I made with my child exactly. in the backyard.
Well, I think that there's an interesting point to be made there. I mean, one of your articles, I think it was that article, actually, you talked about like that this has nothing to do with craft, like Mod Podge had nothing to do with craft. And I think there's actually a challenger that I think many other people could probably do well, which is to make those materials actually seem high quality and innovative mm-hmm. and interesting mm-hmm. or use them as tools on the path to doing that. But I think this show kind of took the easiest possible route out, which was, let's just decorate a birdhouse with popsicle sticks. And I think that's why people think that craft is kind of kitschy or cheap or just decorative.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, there are definitely interesting things you could do with Mod Podge and probably also craft foam. But given the craft foam always has a strange texture. I can't imagine that's it true. Being that nice. But, you know, given the parameters of the challenges, they've really made it aim for the lowest common denominator. And my main objection to Mod Podge is that, you know, you slap it, it's sticky. So anything will stick to something else. So it is, in a way, the fastest way to change the appearance of something. But I think really interesting making is not just about changing the appearance, but how you've changed the appearance. Mm-hmm. And just painting something with a sticky substance is not that interesting as a mode of making. If everything is in the show, if you never go beyond making with Mod Podge, yes, you can make a lot of things that are your own, but it doesn't, you know, I don't think you can progress it that much.
Well, I think something that's popping up is the idea of time as mm-hmm. a factor. Yes. And I think with the reality TV, obviously that's a given. And for me, that's why there's never been a successful design show on television. I think we all got, the blogging community got very excited for Top Design on Bravo. And I mean, Todd was involved. I was very excited about that. And the show to me was just a giant hot mess. And I think primarily for me, the issue was I do not think great interior design, especially if you're doing anything innovative, happens in like a 1 or 2 day span, even though they're given a big blank white box. So I guess it wasn't maybe as challenging as people thought, but I don't think innovation happens that quickly. Do you think that's a factor?
Yeah, I definitely think that's a factor. And yes, I also did my time with Top Design and really really wanted to love it, because it's like, oh, I'm the target demographic mm-hmm. for this. But yes, I hated it. But you know, actually bringing up the fact that you know, the designers on that show were each given a plain white box is very similar to my issue with a lot of the challenges for Craft Wars, mm-hmm. where they're given, essentially, they're not given a birdhouse, but somebody in the back makes a birdhouse yeah. that they then decorate. So on Top Design, they were given a white box that they then decorate. But most interior design, you are not given a white mm-hmm. box. You're given, you know, real people with real stuff in a house with quirks, or an apartment with an unfortunate layout, or mm-hmm. and I think that design is better and richer for those challenges. And so there's something inherently wrong with the way that these shows are set up that makes the resulting design worse.
Do you think it's possible for maybe the craft that I think you and I share mm-hmm. sort of a love of the same type of craft or design, is it possible for that to be on mainstream television? That I don't know if it is.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a TV producer, as, you know, people like to point out in the comments on things. But I guess I always return to those first few seasons of Project Runway, which I really loved and I found really exciting because I saw talented people in, you know, fairly limited amounts of time taking materials and making something really beautiful, something that hung together and was original. And I feel like maybe, you know, the parameters have to be different, but it's true on Project One Way in general, they do have a little more control over their materials and they are given a bit more time. So I guess I feel like it must be possible. But you do have to, you know, monkey with all of the parts. Like, is it more time that makes a difference? Is it, you know, making Craft Wars more like the Unusual Materials Challenge on Project Runway, which is always my favorite. I mean, the designers roll their eyes, but I think it's awesome.
That's where the corn dress came from.
Exactly. The corn dress was incredible. Really incredible.
I mean, for me, that actually comes down to the strength of the competitors. And I wonder if there's sort of a let's slap this show together while this genre is still popular happening. Like, I wonder if they're like, quick, craft is popular. People are putting birds on things. Let's make this a TV show. And so they just think, like, let's find. I mean, I remember I watched the first episode. There was a blogger that I recognized. I recognized her blog. And a couple other people that I felt were very clearly, like, representing demographics they wanted to reach rather than, like, where can we find the most interesting artistic outside of the box type people, which if you had had like an Austin, you know, the design version of Austin Scarlett on that show, I think something more interesting might have happened. But I feel like it's very slapdash in the way that it's like put together.
Right. It's true. We don't know, you know, where they got their contestants from. And Project Runway, obviously, as it became a hit, now they have this whole audition process and hundreds of people. And so, you know, apparently they can cull from top people, though. Frankly, recent seasons, there are a lot of people on there who can't sew, which I just feel like I don't need to spend the time with these people that can't sew.
Yeah. So. Well, I think it's gotten worse. I think when you have more people to choose from, that often happens, primarily because they start to feel like, well, it's not good enough to have a creative person. Now we have to have a creative person that represents this personality type or this niche or whatever it is. And I think in the early stages of a show, they don't necessarily do quite the same thing. And so I think they've lucked out and really focused on creative artsy people. And so every now and then someone interesting sneaks through. But for the most part, I feel like they're really dealing with people who just represent like a personality type that they want on the show.
Right. And it's actually really interesting that so many of the people on Craft Wars have had blogs, even if they don't self-define as bloggers, because that, you know, that's the other thing about the present day crafting community. Everyone is posting the things that they make online and they have these tutorials, and that's actually really amazing. I mean, I've been trying to get back into making some things myself and just going to look for, you know, free quilt patterns. You find a trove of horrible things and a trove of wonderful things. And it really seems like, and I think this is part of what has fueled the rise of Pinterest, part of making is now sharing what you've made in this really public way. And that's something that I think, you know, deserves more thought and consideration.
Well, let's talk about the good and bad parts of that. I mean, I think that the way the internet affects sharing in general is kind of has been revolutionary. And for me, both good and bad ways. I think it's been really epic to be able to connect people who never would have talked to each other and watch how their projects and their work would inform something new or collaborative. But it also sort of puts this bizarre pressure on people to feel like they have to share everything, whether it's not done yet, whether it's not what they would want it to look like. And then I also feel like people just kind of think everything is worthy of sharing when maybe it's not. And I think at a personal hobby level, why not share things? That's fine. But I think the design community in general feels like if it's been made and if it's something that's been like put in an after shot type of format, you might as well share it. What do you think about sort of good, bad sharing?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, all of the social media formats are designed to make it as easy as possible to share. I mean, I just read an interview with I think it's David Karp from Tumblr, and he said, oh, some people were intimidated by, you know, the WordPress format where you have to type words. So we have it at the top. You can have a photo, you can have a link, you can have a quote. So again, it lowers the bar for sharing. And I don't know if that's good or bad, but it puts more of an onus on people to think about what they're sharing and self-edit because it's so easy. I mean, it's like the trouble that people keep getting into on Twitter when they sort of act like they're talking to their friends, but they're a journalist and they're actually talking to, you know, thousands of people they don't know. I mean, I love Twitter. I use Twitter, but I do always think about it pretty much as part of my professional persona. So with craft, the same thing is true. You know, once you've started posting something once a week, you feel like you have to keep up. So then you start posting something once a week, even if it's not done. And, and in fact, the posting starts to be the pressure on your project. And then I don't know, you know, this is not my personal experience, but maybe then you start doing only projects that are shorter term. And so the quality of your work declines. And you can lose sight of what you loved about it in the first place.
Exactly. I think the writing and the discussion and the passion behind whatever the thing you're talking and posting about gets completely lost. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk more about how writing and maybe discussion and maybe even criticism has gotten lost in blogs.
Today's program has been brought to you by Clarkson Potter Publishers. Today's featured book is The First Apartment Book by Kyle Schuneman and Heather Somerville. A first apartment allows you to finally do what you want with your own space, but it can be tricky to decorate. Luckily, 27-year-old decorating prodigy Kyle Schuneman knows that a paper-thin wallet and four plain walls don't have to stand in your way. And the 10 amazing, real apartments in this book show it. From coast to coast, these fabulous first homes are the perfect balance between cool design and comfort, and they offer plenty of practical ideas for making your apartment feel open, organized, and inviting. Examples include multifunctional studios, a loft that was sectioned into livable areas, cookie-cutter apartments with one-of-a-kind personality, shared spaces that accommodate different decorating tastes, and fantastic examples of how to display collections, hide unsightly stuff, and manage picky landlords. Kyle's creative solutions reveal how you can make your space feel much larger than it really is, and how it can reflect your passions, travels, and your location. Full of bold, vibrant photos, an extensive resource section, and hundreds of big ideas for small spaces, this book proves that there are no limits on how spacious and cool your first apartment can feel. The First Apartment Book by Kyle Schuneman and Heather Somerville is $24.99 and is available wherever books are sold. Stitcher? Heritage Radio Network is on it, so get it. Stitcher is an award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.
Hey, welcome back to After the Jump. I'm your host, Grace Bonney, and today I'm speaking with Alexandra Lang, a Brooklyn-based critic, journalist, and architectural historian. We've been talking about craft, what it means, the presence of criticism on blogs, and how the mainstream media has been defining craft. I really want to get back to what we were just talking about right before the break, about sort of Tumblr and WordPress and people making it easier to share things without the presence of words, which may be an oversimplification, but I think is sort of playing into what maybe some of your issues have been with craft and things that I think actually a lot of bloggers feel internally, but aren't maybe discussing so outwardly. And I know for me, that's one of the things that when you get stuck in the machine of having to produce content every day, I feel like after a while, words start to become less important, or they seem like the afterthought. It's like all about sharing this great picture because it feels like that's what your readers want versus like actual discussion. Do you feel that's happening?
Yeah. I mean, I've had some amount of personal dissent from design blogs for a while, in the sense that I have felt for a long while like both design and architecture blogs have basically, many of them have turned into eye candy. And that means that a certain kind of product then gets featured more often because it looks good, because it's yellow, because in architecture it's swoopy, because that looks better in the format of a blog, and because most things are being shared are only known as photographs, then all the quality judgment is being made based on this photograph. And as we know, that's not really the important part of architecture, and that's not really the important part of design. It's how it works. And the more design blogs there are, the less likely it is for the person behind it to have actually touched the object. And I just think that is a really big problem.
It's a big issue. I mean, as a blogger, I'll have to say it's difficult because it's impossible for us to possibly hold and discuss everything.
Right.
So I think it does lead to sort of just general enthusiasm for work, which I feel is okay to exist in a blog world. But I think one of the points you've made, you wrote a really interesting article called, I'm reading it right here. It was called The Anatomy of Uncriticism, and you mentioned Tina Roth Eisenberg from Swiss Miss, you mentioned Design Sponge, and you were talking about people who seem almost afraid to be critical. And mm-hmm. I read that, and we were talking before we started recording about, I talked to a lot of my blogger friends, and I actually really enjoyed that article because I think it's important for the design community to receive criticism, to sort of look at the way it discusses things, and I very much appreciate getting feedback on what I should be doing better. And so I agreed. I thought when I started Design Sponge, I know a lot of bloggers felt this way. You know, maybe a decade ago, most of the blogs I was reading, they were political. They were like snarky for the sake of being snarky. And I remember I read Wonkette really closely, and I mm-hmm. thought that brand of snark was exciting and fun. But at a certain point, I didn't want my blog to be that. And so I decided I'm not going to talk about things if I can't say anything nice about them. But that community doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. The community that I'm within now is an almost overwhelmingly positive one. And so I think what you've been suggesting online is that people sort of, there needs to be more education, there needs to be more discussion of where things have come from, and a sort of awareness of history that doesn't really exist on most blogs. What sort of changes would you like to see in design and architecture, blogging in general, that you think would make the blogs more well-rounded?
Well, I completely understand, you know, that you can't touch everything, and certainly not if you're posting, you know, 8 things a day or 3 things a day even. But I don't think that means that design blogs couldn't have a regular weekly column in which they do, take something and really evaluate it. Maybe something that you posted about. It's like, okay, I was really enthusiastic about this a month ago. Now I've gotten it. And, you know, the quality is not that good. The top falls off every time I try to pour my cup of tea, whatever. I mean, that is really, you know, very basic, you know, product object design criticism. And I don't really see why that couldn't coexist with the nice pictures and the enthusiasm. I mean, I did a column for Gourmet magazine on coffee makers last year, where a friend of mine and I went to Bed Bath & Beyond and just kind of assessed all the coffee makers on the shelf. Like, this is so tall. This carafe is hard to pull out. Where's the on-off switch? Why can't I see how much water it's in it? And I feel like there could be so much more of that because mm-hmm. It is consumer, but it's also about the quality of the thing. And that's, I mean, I think that's why people are seeking independent design these days, is for greater quality. So let's talk about what it's really like.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah. I just want to add one quick thing. I think what you just ended on saying, like people looking for greater quality, I don't actually feel that in a blog audience. I feel like what people are looking for is a greater quantity of design information. I feel like the difference between people who, when magazines were the only option, I felt strongly that because people had to pay for them, they very much paid attention to like which magazine's voice they trusted more. Mm-hmm. And I think now that people don't have to pay for design blogs or even online magazines, they're all free for the most part, people will read all of them. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like there's less decision making happening, and it's more about like, I'll just consume 30 of these different opinions, and then maybe they'll go with the one that they like the most or that feels more like them. But I wish I felt that like a pressure. I want to feel a pressure to like be, you know, more judicious with the things that I write about, but I don't actually feel that from the design
community. That's interesting. Gosh, I feel like if people are reading 30 blogs and online magazines, they must be seeing the same stuff lot of times, because that is definitely something that I see across the genre. The same objects, the same throw pillows, etc., just come up over and over again. And sometimes I wonder, did that publicist send them to all of these people?
Yes.
Or is everyone just feeling the green bug this month, and so they all picked it? I mean, all of these things. It's actually more depressing to me when you see the same things. It's like, how distinctive is people's taste? Because in some ways, the design blog that you want to read every day tends to be the one that tracks most closely with your own taste, so you really like everything on it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's some part of me that thinks that, like, the internet should, if everyone happens to like a green chevron pillow this month, they should have the right to do that. But I feel like for the bloggers who are taking their site seriously, or like would like to make it a job or career for a long time, you do have a responsibility to try to find a way to at least put a spin on that, or not write about it if everyone's already written about it. But one thing I'm curious to ask you about, because you do write online, you do have comments, people comment on your work and you see responses. I think one of the reasons people don't do negative posts, and I this is the way I feel, but I know other friends of mine, we've discussed this, feel the same way, is if you are almost exclusively positive, or you don't say, really intensely negative things online, people really single out the things that you do say negative, and you get like, why did you take the time to single out this one person? It seems like as if you're doling out way more negativity than if you always did it. And so people are terrified of the blowback, of the commenting being like, why would you do this to this one person? It seems extra negative. Like, how does negative commentary, like in comment section form, affect the things you choose to say as a critic?
Well, I have to say that my blog gets so many fewer readers, I believe, than your blog. And there are many fewer comments. Now, I've taken the comments on blogs like Design Sponge to task for largely being, that's
yay,
so cute.
It's pretty.
Yeah. Which to me is that even if I thought it was cute in the first place, by the end of 17 comments like that, I don't feel that it's cute anymore. But that is definitely, the critic's personality. So yes, there are a lot of comments. Do the comments have content? Are they creating a discussion? I think the way some people get around it is posing these issues in the form of a question. Mm-hmm. And I do think people feel more, are more likely to comment if they feel like it's a question and it's kind of an evolving discussion, rather than you as blogger coming down and saying, this is how it has to be. Because I think then sometimes people feel like, oh, she's made up her mind. Mm-hmm. I don't even need to comment on that. Or I'll go back to my own blog and comment on it. So I guess I would say it definitely matters how you frame it. And if you have a certain blogging personality, you have to figure out how to frame it so that maybe you can bring your readers along.
Mm-hmm.
I know on Design Sponge, you've evolved a lot of different columns. There was one, I think one of your co-writers was doing for a while on history.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was great. I thought that was exactly the kind of thing that you should have every week. There are all these terms people throw around. There are all these designers. It's like, if you're interested in design, increase the knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also seen that you've struggled with how to be critical,
yeah,
even though the truth is you are making judgments all day, every day.
Oh, yeah.
In your inbox. So, I mean, then it comes down to a question of transparency. Like, how can you be more transparent about what it is that you're not putting on mm-hmm. the blog? I think that would be really interesting. It's partially about being more honest and not presenting our lives as being filled with fresh flowers and mm-hmm. mint tea all the time.
And that's a huge discussion happening right now. I've done the last couple shows of this radio show about sort of struggling with, I think, all bloggers trying to be more honest about representing their lives and mm-hmm. even representing difficult things in your lives. You still try to find a way to like spin that to make it more attractive or more palatable and more sympathetic almost. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes difficult. It's part of that sharing thing of like, how do I digest this moment in my life or this moment in my blog into like an Instagram photo? Like, how do you take that all into one perfect thing? But we're running out of time, and I want to ask you one quick question. Where do you sort of see the relationship between sort of serious critics like yourself, bloggers like me, sort of like there's a wide range of people with voices in design right mm-hmm. now. And I think a lot of people want everyone to be the same or to have the same mm-hmm. standards. Where do you see them all playing together ideally?
I see people feeling the need to read all of them. I know that critics are never going to be as popular as enthusiasts. I just don't think that's going to mm-hmm. happen. But I would like, it's like sometimes I think maybe the more popular blogs could do more to support some of the critics, mm-hmm. even if they don't want to do it. It's like, look, this is something else happening in the design blogosphere. This might interest you. It's different. It's mm-hmm. not what I do, but because so many of the design blogs have gotten so big, and why can't they use a little bit of that popularity to kind of expand mm-hmm. the pool and be supportive of the larger community? I mean, just an example of that, I see, you know, the blog Curbed is a real estate blog, but they started having architecture criticism mm-hmm. on their blog, which I thought was a great thing, because people are interested in this topic. Maybe they don't think they're interested in that way, but at least there's an opportunity to get a taste of it.
Absolutely. It's a good point to leave on. I feel like everyone's a blogger these days. I feel like I always think like, oh, I should really change this on my blog. But I think everybody, it would be helpful for people to think more about trying to find ways to call attention to serious discussions happening within the community. Because I feel like the place that we're different on is that I don't feel like all blogs have a responsibility to sort of be critics, but I do feel like you have a responsibility to sort of find a way to call attention to all the discussions happening in the community, even if they're not happening on your blog.
Yeah. It's always surprising to me how many people haven't heard of some blog that I see all the time. I mean, this is partially, you know, being somebody in the media and being on Twitter, you sort of get all of this information. And there are people that only know one or two blogs. And it's like, oh, there's this whole range out there. And how do you let people know about the range? And then they can pick and choose the ones that they want and that, you know, what they can live with.
All right. Well, I'm personally going to hold myself responsible now for pointing to bigger discussions. I'm glad you came and talked with me today. Thanks so much for sharing your opinion online and sharing it here today. And you can find Alexandra's work online at The Observer. And you have a website, Alexandra. Is it alexandralang.com?
No, actually, most of my work is on Design Observer. I have a blog there, and that has links to all of my work.
Okay, perfect. Go check them out, especially the last three. They've been incredibly interesting. And if you're at all interested in craft, it's a very relevant discussion happening right now. So thanks for being here, Alexandra.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. HeritageRadioNetwork.org is the most trusted media outlet for real, quality conversations about food. That experience will come to life at our first annual members-only fundraiser party on September 9th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Enjoy the best food in the world from talent including Michael Anthony, award-winning chef from Gramercy Tavern, Brooks Headley, award-winning pastry chef from Del Posto, Shauna Pacifico at Back 40 West, sustainable seafood from Sea to Table, and much more, including drinks made by Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues, craft beer from Greenpoint Harbor Brewery, wine from Cane Vineyard and Winery in the Napa Valley, and plenty more. Radio is back, and this will be a special, exclusive experience in the back garden of Roberta's that you don't want to miss. September 9th, 5 to 8 p.m. Buy tickets at heritageradionetwork.eventbrite.com.